Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Many of you are familiar with Lorraine Hansberry's landmark drama, A Raisin in the Sun. It's a classic play. It's one we've talked about. It looks at race, the meaning of home. It's set in mid-century Chicago. But some of us didn't know, we should have, but we didn't know that there is a very well-received sequel, Cliburn Park, which looks at the whole situation 50 years later. The great thing for Chapel Hill is that both plays are now on stage, thanks to the playmakers, and we're going to talk to the directors of each of the productions. They're being performed in real house, and they're
in repertory,
so you can watch them. Sometimes you can watch them both on the same day. And Rael Myrick Hodges is familiar to us in Chapel Hill. We want to adopt her.
She's so,
and she is directing Raisin, and she's brought the director of Cliburn and one of the great actors in the play that she's directing. So tell what's going on over there.
Well, first of all, I am.
You want to introduce your colleagues?
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm Rael, as you know, and I'm directing A Raisin in the Sun. But the other Pulitzer Prize winning play is being directed by my dear friend, Tracy Young, who is an amazing director. And she is directing Cliburn Park. And our other guest is Mikhail Suleiman, who is the lead in A Raisin in the Sun, who I've known.
He's your lead.
He was a young boy.
Yeah.
So is that right? So you, when you agreed to come, you had an actor in mind.
Well, actually, let's talk the little story about Mikhail. Mikhail doesn't act, quote unquote. He quit.
I never quit. But I just said I put it in the back seat. I went to school for acting. And actually, my first professional show was directed by Rael.
Oh, come on now.
Which happened to be her first
play that I directed.
No. And so after that, you quit. No.
Well, exactly. I said, all right, the hell with this. No, but after the years, I started to fall in love with other things like music, sound design, photography, and really kind of put acting to the side. And do you want to tell the story of how I actually ended up
here?
It
was a crushing blow the day I get the phone call of, I have decided I'm not going to act anymore. I was traumatized. This is about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, but I mean, it is. I mean, we were talking the other day with some friends. Can't get too far into this, but just basically, my mother had wanted to be an actress, and then she met my daddy, and everything worked out fine. But we thought, so we were left to imagine that, you know, she would have been the greatest actress. But in all likelihood, she would have been a journeyman actress, mm-hmm. Struggling, you know, always looking for work, having periods of excitement, and then periods of just can't find the right thing. And so it's a struggle, I guess, to be an actor.
Right. There's the practical struggle, but I think there's the philosophical struggle as an artist in general that I think becomes the complexity for a lot of us as artists. So it's really hard to wake up every morning and be creative. I think people they make this assumption that you become an artist because you're lazy. And I think the irony is you become an artist because you have too much going on. You have too much you want to share, and there's a lot of work to be had to do that every day.
So is that the reason you think? I mean, do you think? Well, I'm going to ask him in a minute, but I want to ask you first what you're thinking that Mikhail is struggling with the very hard component of being creative every day and having those expectations, or do you think he was struggling with the very hard facts of making a life as an actor?
Well, I think most importantly, he couldn't be in every play with me, and therefore, who wants to be acting?
I can understand that.
Yeah,
I can understand that. Is that now? What's your story, Cal?
Well, no, I really want to actually hear your real answer. Actually, I'm curious because she's known me for what is it now? 10 years.
10 years.
Yeah.
You have to understand, the first time I saw Mikhail ever audition, he was maybe 19 years old.
Where were you?
Philadelphia, okay. Pennsylvania. And he was still in university there. And he was lovely, fantastic, even at that age. I think there's a lot that goes on. The rigmarole between the mix of live art performance and television and film and what you think you can get if you're doing all these other kinds of things, the money, the travel, all of that becomes extremely exacerbating to the spirit if you're not really enjoying the majority of your time doing it. And I think that every single artist I've ever met, including myself, even now, we go through the period of saying, oh, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not sure he would be acting right now had I not been, honestly, seriously, directing this show. And I called him in the middle of the night and told him he had to audition.
She called me in the middle of the night from Mexico. Do you want to tell that story? Which is a very strange story, but we'll maybe start on that one later.
No, 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 let's go with that. Let's go with that.
She was in Mexico working with Freedom Fighters? I mean, I don't know what they're called.
Yeah, working with the Zapatista community and with Emery Douglas
in the jungles of Mexico.
Panthers in Chiapas, Mexico.
Oh my gosh.
And I get a random phone call in Brooklyn, and she's like, the actor who's supposed to be playing Walter Lee just went to Broadway, and he's there with Scarlett Johansson on the Cat in the Hot Tin Roof. And I need you to send a video to.
So, this is the black version of Cat on the Hot
Tin Roof? No, it's not. He's playing. I don't know exactly who he's playing, but it's on Broadway right now. It's starring Scarlett Johansson, and he's a character in the show.
Well,
I don't know.
Okay. So he got to be on Broadway, and he gave up?
He gave up the opportunity to work with Rael. I think he kind of, yeah.
He messed up, but thank goodness for you, he messed up. And so she's desperate. She called. She remembers
you.
Never
desperate.
Never desperate.
Yes, you were, too. And so, no, but you remember. I mean, this is a great story. This should be written up. That you remember this wonderful person who's on the borderline of being an actor or going into these other things?
We've been in contact this whole time. I honestly, genuinely believe, and I'm not saying this because he's in the room, I honestly believe that Mikhail Suleiman is one of the best actors I've ever worked with.
And so you're not desperate. You say, this is an opportunity.
I would have wanted him from the start. I just assumed he wouldn't have wanted to do the show. And I wouldn't have called him had I not gone through the regular avenues, because I do respect him as an artist and I do respect his choices as an artist. Wow. But we're also friends, and he never lets his friends down. So when they call from Mexico, you have a tendency to say,
so you just did this. I mean, you're doing this as a favor to her more than as a step in your going back, maybe considering going back into acting as a part of your professional life.
I mean, it's interesting. I do have to kind of stop you there to say that it's a favor, because it's not. It's a privilege, you know, to work with Rael.
Yeah, like, I know what you're talking about.
And again, I'm not saying it because she's here. She's genuinely, I feel like there will be a point where there will be books written about her and her story. No, really, her story and the way she's worked and the people she's worked with. But I'll curb that because I don't want you to have too much glad handing. I know. But
can't you say something mean about her?
I mean, we'll get there. But really, it was one of those things where it was like, wow, you know, to do Raisin in the Sun, this landmark play. Walter Lee is one of the most complex roles written for.
Talk about, those folks who are listening to us, they love us talking about how great you all are and this great story, which is really a great story. But tell us a little bit about your character, and then we'll take a break and come back and let Rael tell us some more about the play.
Absolutely. Well, Walter Lee, what I was going to say is that, you know, he's by far one of the most complex characters written about a quote-unquote contemporary black male.
Tell us all about him. How old is he? Where does he live?
He's 35 years old. He's been married 11 years. That's one of the lines from the play. And he's living with his mother. His father had recently died. And he's also living with his sister and his wife and his son, Travis. And essentially, he's trying to reclaim his manhood, I guess I could say,
in a certain way. Excuse me, but just trying to put it in context that folks here in Chapel Hill, this is in Southside Chicago. This is the area that Barack Obama, years later, came to serve and be a community organizer about.
Yeah, I never made that connection.
And so we know this as being, I mean, we just have this vague image of this being, this is changing, tough. You know, there's a lot going on there, so it's a complex setting. That we won't see that on the stage, but this is what your character is dealing with.
You might not see. So I don't know all the complexities that you're referencing, but there are a lot of complexities in regards to, you know, the time of, you know, my mother's generation. I'm speaking as Walter, who came up from the South, former slaves who were, you know, trying to escape, you know, Jim Crow laws and, you know, slavery and stuff like that. You know, to now having opportunity to, quote unquote, come into the middle class, you know, that's a big jump, you know. And then to, like you're referencing, Barack Obama, you know, essentially Walter Lee could have been the father of a Barack Obama. You know, granted, of course, his father was from Africa. There's a whole other story.
Right.
And then to just see those kinds of big jumps and leaps, and then to see Clyburn, which, you know, it's just a brilliant play, you know, and it's a great marriage to raise in. That then you see what happens when essentially the son of a possible Barack is now, or I don't know the age of that character, but now goes to Zurich. There's a black character who is... you know, goes to Prague and skis.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's just like
this really interesting thing of just seeing those leaps and bounds that, I mean, you know, without being so patriotic, you know, really could only happen in America. Yeah. You know?
Well, this is fantastic. We're talking about the Playmakers' two productions in repertoire. One is A Raisin in the Sun, if you join us late. And then the other is sort of a sequel to A Raisin in the Sun, set the same place, some of the same people, but 50 or so years later. We're going to come back and talk to the directors of both of those productions after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with a great group of dramatists, Ray O'Merrick Hodges, Tracy Young, who are the directors, respectively, of Raisin in the Sun and Clyburn, and then the lead actor in Raisin in the Sun, Cal Suleiman. We're learning a lot about the stories that went behind the play. Riel, will you tell us a little bit about, for just pretend like these folks who are listening can't remember about A Raisin in the Sun. Mm-hmm. Tell us, give us a little bit of the story that enchants you or intrigues you that you like the most.
What I love the most about A Raisin in the Sun is the fact that it's the journey of a mother who has to come to terms with watching her son struggle and be triumphant in how she raised him. Mm. Ultimately, that's what the play is about, which I think is a huge part of what goes on for a lot of the black community in the United States. And again, I just like to say, DG, which I always say, is I use the word black because not every person who has brown skin is from the continent of Africa. Some of us are Jamaican, some of us are Haitian, and so it's
the preferred term. This is
for me.
No, I love this because I mean we have a great black faculty member on this campus, one of the best history teachers I think in the world. And she is of Jamaican origin. She grew up in New York in the Jamaican mm-hmm. community. And she has an intense loyalty both to Jamaica, to where she grew up. Now, if you go way back, she's African, Jamaican, American, or something like that. But you prefer black.
Personal level, because I do have friends that are from other parts of the
other
world
regions
who have skin as dark as mine who are not from the continent of Africa. And so
we have Indians who are darker skin than
sure. Even, and they also are not from the continent of Africa.
No, but they're really not from the continent of Africa. But my Jamaican is indirectly from the continent of Africa. Not by, you know, like I'm like my, you know, we all kind of, here we go again.
Mm-hmm.
We say Scotch Irish,
right?
You know, and that's now that's a, not a preferred term for where some of my people came from, but they were originally from Scotland, but then they were kind of put in Ireland for a few years, where they either were oppressed the natural population of Ireland, and then couldn't get along there, so they came to America, and so they call them Scotch Irish. But some people called them Irish, some people called them Scotch, and they were offended by all of, you know, they wanted to just be called Ulster people.
Oh,
so this is not an African American family, this is a black family.
To me, it is. Mm-hmm. And so it's the story of this family that I think that we have our preconceived notions about what is considered displaced communities, right? You take what our stereotype is of a family of color who has no money, who is in a displaced part of a major metropolitan area, and we start to call it the black family or the of this. And so to me, A Raisin in the Sun, it could have been called The Raisin in the Sun, but I think that Jess, her genius as a writer is that it is one glimpse of one family with a series of different types of ideas about what it's like to be a black person.
Help us a little bit and talk about the particular situation that this black family finds itself in.
We have a family where the patriarch of the family has passed away recently. We have decided it's been at least a year with the assumption that they are then expecting some insurance money to come in. When the insurance money gets in, it's about what they're going to do with this money and what ensues after that.
So, and it's like winning the lottery, you know, that a family has there's a little bit of money and then there are all kinds of things. There's a difference of ideas about who is entitled to spend the money and then how it's going to be used. And, you know, the play has been around for a long time, so you're not really giving, you know, we like to see it. You're not really giving away anything if we talk about the story a little
bit. I would hope not. I hope that everyone listening has read A Raisin in the Sun.
Yeah, well, tell
if
us.
They've read Cat on the Hot Tin Roof.
Yeah, but if they haven't, not everybody has. So tell us a little. See, you caught me. You got me caught because you say I'm not going to give away the story, but I hope everybody knows it. So tell us a little bit. I mean, this is a story that is, even if you remember it, it works well to see it again.
It's about a young man who is. I mean, it's like a lot of families of color right now that are run by they're matriarchal. You have your mother, you're living with, you know, you have a strong male that's living with three strong women. And how does that relationship play itself out? What does that mean? Our stereotype of the black male of like this aggressor and this. Very few black men I know actually get a word in edgewise when they're sitting in the room with their mother, their grandmother, and their sister. Ever. So it's one of the beautiful things about this play is that it takes what we think of as the displaced black poor family on the south side of Chicago and has a discussion about having hope and dream, about education, about the importance of education, about the complexity of being pro-choice or anti-abortion, the complexity of the importance of education, the beauty of being a young child watching grown-ups sometimes acts like children themselves. So it takes on these huge issues that then lend themselves straight away into Bruce Norris's Clybourne Park.
Well, we have the director of Clybourne Park. Maybe can you persuade her to tell us a little bit about that play?
And I'm hoping so. And so, yeah,
you said that Tracy, y'all, this is an inbred group, but you said Tracy Young, the director of Clybourne, is one of your best friends.
She is now.
Just from, so you all
from this experience.
She's a people person.
So,
people.
This is a new best friendship. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And I hope one that will endure going forward. I have no doubt. I admire her so much, and she's an amazing person, brilliant, and
I'm gonna let's take a break because I've told them they can't do this. We're gonna come. We are gonna take a break, and we're gonna talk.
Everybody, pass me the ball. I'm just taking it where it was.
We're gonna come back and talk to Tracy Young about the sequel to A Raisin in the Sun, which is Clybourne. We're really gonna do it this time. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. We're talking about the Playmakers' current production and repertory of A Raisin in the Sun and Clybourne. We've been talking about A Raisin in the Sun, and Tracy Young, who directs Clybourne, says we keep promising we're going to talk about Clybourne, and I want to talk about it. But here's what I want you to do first, Tracy, is to talk about how you see A Raisin in the Sun as you have to set it up to be the sort of the sequel to it. But tell us about A Raisin in the Sun as you see it, and then tell us about how Clybourne follows up, is a part or is not a part of that play?
Well, there's so much to say about A Raisin in the Sun. My own personal, just why I think it's a classic piece, why I think it still endures, why I think it's one of the finest American plays. But I think more interestingly in this conversation is what I imagined the playwright Bruce Norris responded to about A Raisin in the Sun, and why he was sort of moved to create this response piece in a way to Raisin in the Sun. And that's sort of a fascinating thing because Bruce Norris is a, he's, I think he's, I don't know, 50 years old now. So he grew up in Texas, and he's sort of famously quoted as saying that the only black person that he was exposed to growing up was his maid in his house growing up, and that when he was about 13, they showed the film of A Raisin in the Sun in one of his classes in school, and he sort of felt this awareness of, we were talking a little bit about identity and how you self-identify, how society or your community identifies you, what that language terminology is, so on and so forth. But for Bruce Norris, watching A Raisin in the Sun, he was sort of seeing himself reflected in the one white character that's in that piece. And that character's name is Carl Lindner. And he essentially... I don't want to give too much away. I don't
You're
know.
You're not
but,
giving
okay,
it's
all right,
an old
all right, all right.
story.
All right, all right. Well, he comes.
Go to Wikipedia and you can
okay.
see the whole thing.
It's true. It's true. So Carl Lindner appears briefly in A Raisin in the Sun, essentially to attempt to dissuade the family from moving from their basically tenement apartment into what is a almost exclusively white suburban neighborhood. In the sort of outlying area around Chicago. And he comes as a sort of representative of the neighborhood association and sort of tries to be very reasonable, tries to be very friendly, and essentially offer the younger family an incentive to not move. And so that presents, obviously, a big source of conflict.
This was where he identified with the white character
so
trying to persuade the black family not to move into the all-white
so
neighborhood.
He was seeing himself, within the context of being portrayed essentially as a sort of villain in the piece, a sort of negative harbinger of a very problematic situation and a reflection of, obviously, kind of a very common... situation at that time.
I'm going to interrupt you just for a moment as a white character, white person who might also identify with this character. But here, there's a parallel story in Chapel Hill.
Mm-hmm. I've heard about this.
Have you? This is Howard Lee, who became our mayor and is just a highly regarded person. Moved to Chapel Hill, was able to pretty quickly to achieve not wealth, but modest middle class. And wanted to move into a regular neighborhood. And so he encountered the same sort of nice discouragement of, these kinds of things. And he tells the story eloquently in his memoir. So we identify, the white people like me who can look back to 50 years ago, identify like this playwright did.
Yes. And I think one of the fascinating things that the play does so compellingly is that essentially Act One of the play is set in 1959 at the same exact time at the time that A Raisin in the Sun is basically unfolding across town in this other neighborhood. This Act One of Clybourne Park is unfolding, and this character of Carl Lindner is the one character that's
He's
written
the
into
bridge
both
character.
Plays.
Sorry? He's the bridge. He's the bridge.
He's the bridge character, exactly. So that's a really interesting and just a very, I find it a very exciting theatrical device that the playwright decided to do that and take that character as the one that kind of traverses both the worlds. So that's interesting unto itself. But then further, what he does is that Act Two of the play flashes forward 50 years to the very same house in this what's now become... a predominantly black neighborhood, same house, the neighborhood demographic has changed, but you've got characters now in 2009 kind of coming up against, it's almost a, what do you call it, like a photo negative, the sort of like, it's the mirror of Act One in many ways, different set of characters, it's a whole different set, but the dynamics are the same. Different language, different terminology, different ways of interacting. Obviously more in the contemporary framework of how we talk to each other about race, how we don't, how we couch it, the dynamics that are at play, the socioeconomic considerations. But like you just mentioned, I think one of Bruce Norris's main thrusts for writing this play was kind of to make a commentary on the old adage of the more things change, the more they stay the same. And this kind of sometimes, you know, even though we have Barack Obama in the White House, even though we have, you know, even though certain progressive strides have been made for Americans as a culture, there are also still these, you know, underlying dynamics that we still are struggling with. We're still trying to find our way to be able to even talk about. So
it's interesting. Like
this is Mikhail.
As
who's Walter in Raising in the Sun?
Yeah. Watching it the other day, I saw a preview of it. And it's really pretty excellent. What it made me think about, though, is that although things stay the same, they also kind of mutate. Mm-hmm. Like that, the one character I was talking about earlier, who goes to ski in Switzerland and
this
goes
is
to
the
Prague.
Tell us this is the play in Clive. I mean, a character in Clive. I mean, is he white or black?
He's black character.
And so he's
in 2009 who goes to Prague.
He's been transformed by this. He's made it. Kind of.
He's made it, but more than anything, he's essentially a contemporary black male. I've been to Switzerland. I've been to Sweden. I've been to, you know, Austria. And, you know, I think of myself as just a typical black male, young black male. But what it does tell me, though, is that it's becoming a time of ideal tribes or tribes made up about ideas and about class. You know, that, you know, if you can afford to be in this community who go to skiing in Switzerland, you can do it, whether you're black, white, Asian, whatever, you know. And I think that with the play does, which is really interesting and kind of subversive, is that it's not so much about the race, not to give away too much, but still, like you said, they can go to Wikipedia. It's not so much about race, but it's more about ideas. And do you have the same ideas that I share, or the same aesthetics, or the same sensibilities?
The difference, if there are a developing difference,
right,
is that while we... when I was growing up, when I was your age, mm-hmm, it was almost all black or white.
Right,
you know, you're black, you're this way, you're
exactly
white this way. Right now, a young person is, color might still be a part of it, but primarily it is, have you been to Switzerland?
Exactly.
Do these things?
Brought this up before. Tracy and Rael did a great job of letting both of the cast hang out together a lot, especially at the beginning. And one of the things I brought up earlier, and I don't remember where I saw this, and hopefully one of your listeners might know, and hopefully they can maybe email in. I don't know if there's a place to do that. But there was a great study about how specifically people who were born in like the early 2000s and, you know, the late 90s, race is one of the last things that they use as an identifier. Some of us older people, I'm 32 now, may say, oh, yeah, he was, you know, a thin black male who was blah, 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 blah. Someone from your generation might say a black male who was pretty thin, blah, blah, blah. And these, you know, younger people say, you know, he was wearing a brown hat. He was, you know, baggy jeans, blah, blah, blah. It was a Led Zeppelin T-shirt. Oh, yeah. And I think he was black. You know what I mean? And it's just interesting how, you know, race goes lower and lower and lower. Mm. And ideals become like, oh, yeah, I think he was a punk guy, or he was a goth, or he was a rockhead, or he was a hip hop guy, you know, like that. And they'll say a hip hop guy, and someone in your generation might be like, oh, he was a black man. No, he's a white guy. He was a skinny white guy.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm,
the way he wears jeans or the T-shirt he was wearing, you know, would identify him as being hip hop, you know.
And does Clyburn, as you saw it, pick up on this this difference, or does it,
I don't think he makes a very like a overt position on it, but I think he does really subtly kind of like introduce ideas about just how people operate different. I don't know how to put it into words, actually, but no, it's not overt. But I do think it's there, and that's how I got from it. You know,
Tracy. I mean, you agree with all this?
Absolutely, and I think that's. I think like Rael is saying, also, just it's about. There's more complexity in the discourse now. We have intergenerational, and even in the times that what was fascinating in our process, like Mikhail was saying, it was that when our casts were able to sort of hang out together a little bit, we spent a little bit of time just talking about talking amongst ourselves just about many of these topics. And amongst our ensemble of artists, we've got a wide swath of age range within that. So some folks who are in their 60s, some folks who are as young as
22.
Yeah, so 20. this thing that Mikhail is saying is it was absolutely, I think, reflected in the ways that we were talking with each other, our different points of view about how we kind of move through the world with what glasses we're wearing and all of it. And Bruce Norris, I mean, and then we haven't even really touched on the issues about gender, which are another big component of both plays. Rael was talking about it a little bit.
Rael really went into it pretty hard on the gender aspects of the family and raising the son. How does that work out?
Well, I think, like, you know, like Mikhail's saying, this thing of, as a woman, I guess I would speak from personal experience, where it's sort of feels to me, living in this time and place, like it's both, like the gender roles and the definition and that kind of constrained, really rigid gender identity that was put forth to some of the characters, the female characters in Clybourne Park Act One. From the 1950s, you know, certainly that we've got a character that's kind of referencing that kind of Ozzie and Harriet, Donna Reed, housewife, you know, with her perfect little dress and her sort of subservient role in a way, all those kind of classic things that we think of when we think of that time and place and women.
What's that great line she says, like, well, I don't.
Oh, someone says to her, well, you know, knowledge is power, Bev. And she says, well, if that's the case, then I choose to remain powerless. So, you know, he's definitely commenting about some of that in a sly and sort of interesting way. And then the characters in the 2009 segment of the play, the female characters, you know, the ways that the men and the women interact, it's much more complex. The power dynamic has shifted in many of the relationships.
These are white family or black family?
They're both. There's different couples who are kind of facing off in a way, a black couple and a white couple. And, of course, it's this mirror image in a way because it's the black couple who have the investment in the history of this neighborhood, this Clybourne Park neighborhood, now that they've been sort of have built history here and have an identity with the way that the neighborhood was and perhaps should be respected going forward or preserved going forward. And you've got this white couple who are wanting to move in and change the house and, of course, the way that that's affecting the changing of the neighborhood. Just the changing identity of the neighborhood, really. Yeah. And so there is, both sets of couples have been to Prague, and both sets of couples have skied, and both sets of couples on a socioeconomic level have a relationship. That's what I mean kind of about the more layers of complexity, where the different dynamics of what kind of separates us or what causes the sources of conflict, coming up against the sources of identification with different tribes as a way. And tribes is something that Bruce Norris definitely, he views a lot of this piece about reflecting tribes and tribal identity and whatever, you know, whatever that tribe might be. And, you know, we share certain tribal affiliations. We share certain tribal based on age, gender, race, socioeconomic background, and that complex mix. So I think that's kind of how Act Two becomes more.
Well, I can't wait. Can't wait to see it. We're talking about the Playmakers' current productions and repertoire, A Raisin in the Sun and Clybourne, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin, and we're talking about, first of all, about Lorraine Hansberry's great classic play, A Raisin in the Sun, which is being offered by the Playmakers, and by we call it a sequel. What's the right word? A follow-up, a response to A Raisin in the Sun called Clybourne, which is also a wonderfully received Pulitzer Prize-winning play, which is being offered. We get to see them both at the same time.
In a repertory.
Yeah. Rael, you've been here before. You know this audience maybe better than I do, I think, right now. But talk about your play, A Raisin in the Sun, that you're directing, and how it fits in Chapel Hill with Clybourne. What's going on in your mind?
To me, the beauty of putting A Raisin in the Sun and Clybourne Park together is that you have a slew of things that it's really dealing with. First of all, there is something to really celebrate the fact that Lorraine Hansberry was 28 years old, unpublished, and on Broadway at a time where we could not do that right now if we had $2 million to put on a show. It would be virtually impossible, and the complexity of what it would take for that to happen for somebody who has, quote, no experience in that field. That's amazing. To then be followed up and to have written something so effective that someone from Privilege, who is a straight white male with his own complexities as a writer, is able to create a work like Clybourne Park that is inspired by A Raisin in the Sun. To me, what makes the two pieces work so well together is Raisin in the Sun, from the time it's come out till every day, which I find terribly ironic, is the play where everyone says, that's where we're talking about race. I find that interesting because nowhere in the play do the characters really talk about it, except once when Walter Lee makes a comment about all those white guys sitting and watching, I want to be like that. I want to be that kind of businessman. And when Carl Lindner shows up at the front door, they say, there's a white guy at the door. Those are the only times that race is actually discussed outside. They never look at it from the pressure of the outside society. Which makes Clybourne Park so amazing is we are supposed to have gotten over all of that. And yet, even though there's no real discussion about race, supposedly, in that play, the entire thing is heightened by one's perception of others' economics, racial, and gender identity.
So we're free. Excuse me for this, but we're free from whatever generation, racial, ethnic, tribal background we come from to make our own judgments about this.
I think that that's the problem when it comes to race and gender. No one is right or wrong just based off of your random opinion. It's information that you need. And what I think is that that's why it's fine. If you want to use African American, great. If you want to use black, great. If you would like to use Rael, that's even better. And that's kind of the point. And I think that by seeing both of these plays together, it gives you an opportunity to make your own decisions about what's going on in your own life on a personal level. I think you have no choice when you see both of these to have to walk out of the house and go, how well, when was the last time I really had a conversation with my neighbor? You know, how many times do I walk into an elevator?
Enough. Right? You've condemned me. Tracy Young is the director of the follow-up, the Clybourne, the second play that's in repertoire. Closing comments.
Well, I don't want to pile on since Rael already did you good. I think Rael summed my feelings up. I would echo everything she said. And except that you can call me Tracy. Don't call me Rael, because then I'll be confused. But other than that, I mean, it's been it's this theatrical event in this community at this time and place, coming right on the heels of Obama's second inauguration and just everything that's happening in our country, both nationally and locally here in Chapel Hill. And this amazing just opportunity to put these two plays in conversation. I think I've felt the uniqueness and the specialness of that event throughout this process. And I get the sense when I talk to anybody who is planning to come and be an audience member that they're equally excited about, and they recognize why that's such a just a really unique opportunity to view these pieces. And Playmakers is a great organization for
having.
I have
to stop you when you start.
Okay. All these compliments. No more gland hatting. But anyway, it's a great. It just come see it because it's truly special to view these pieces side by side.
Well, and I want to give Mikhail one more last word
because
you are wonderful, Tracy.
Yeah, absolutely. Just come and see it. It's amazing. As an actor, I love watching. Not only the other actors in it, people like Miriam Hyman, and actually I shouldn't name any names, but you know, Matt Gardner, who's also in Clybourne, who was actually hopefully I wish could have been here with me, but it's just they're both actors' plays, meaning that it's the language is really paramount in both, which makes it really exciting to perform in, you know, and both plays handle language differently. What Bruce Norris did with Clybourne and what Lorraine is doing with Raisin, which I'm dealing with, are just very different. But I think coming to see them both is going to be really important. And I mean, I can only speak for myself, but to see Rael Myrikaja's direction, it's something that you have to see.
I can't wait.
You have to see.
I can't wait. Well, y'all, anybody listening is going to be there. And so thanks to the three of you for telling us about these two great productions.
Thank you. And
to all of you, come back soon. We like having you in Chapel Hill. Thanks to you for listening. It's been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.